For those of you who missed my little exchange with Jim Duff that we always do before the show, I just want to repeat a bit of it. You know, my day started out today pretty curmudgeonly fashion, or at least what started it put me in a curmudgeonly fashion. I saw Jumpin' Jack Flash Layton all over the screen talking about talking to the Taliban. And, you know, it's not about militarism, as some callers have said, and it's not about wanting to make war. It's about understanding that we are a free people, and when you hear a political leader talk about discussions that are possible with people that want women to walk five steps behind men and want to kill homosexuals, what do we talk about? You know, I'm an immigrant to this country, but we came out of Eastern Europe to be free. We didn't come here to make money. We didn't come here to be dictated to by government or by priests or rabbis or imams. We came here to live free. And when you take a look at our society today, with most people sitting on their lethargic apathy, willing to sell their own individual consequence for any dictate from government for a few more dollars, and when you see the national cowardice, except for the prime minister, that has been the hallmark of national policy for over a decade, makes you cringe. But every now and then, you look at young people, and you say there's hope. Because just as the best of us are over there doing the heavy lifting, putting their lives on the line to stand with the free, to stand with the principles that are the best of any civilization, you realize that they have the spirit because they haven't gotten soft yet. They haven't sold out yet. There's a fire that still burns brightly. Last night, we had a very affecting interview with a young woman named Nazreen Mohammadi, whose brother Akbar Mohammadi was a leader of the Iranian student dissident movement, and he was killed last month in prison. Part of his torture was having his mouth glued shut. But he managed to write a prison diary called Ideas and Lashes. And part of that diary were poems. And one of the poems ends, "They drink wine and they raise their glasses in your name, O freedom. The dark nights are over, my friend. We will yet see the dawn when the sun shall rise on the edge of freedom." These words could be written by a student activist in jail, having his bones broken, being hung upside down, losing half his sight because blood was rushing out of his eyes, and he still wrote because he knew that words and ideas were all that mattered. It was spirit, not conformity, that was important. And today at lunch, we had a business lunch, and there was a surprise young guest, a young man in his 20s, a Montrealer, West Islander, dual citizenship, American-Canadian. At the age of 17, he volunteered for the U.S. Marines. And he served 9 months in Iraq, and he served a year in Afghanistan. And, you know, when we talk to people who've been there, it's a much different picture from the politicians making political hay or from the chattering class salon liberal media. They tell us about people being helped in real ways, education systems being restored, hospitals functioning, no tyrants killing 100,000 to 200,000 of their own citizens every year, women not being decapitated for sleeping with men out of wedlock. That's what we're fighting for, to make others free also, because we need to be involved as a people in mankind's transcendent yearning for redemptive change. It's not just about, I'm all right, Jack, in the hell with you. Because if that's going to be our attitude, then the very fabric of our own experiment in a just society will corrode. And we're going to take a look at what we're doing. We're going to take a look at Canada's role in those struggles for redemptive change tonight. And we'll be back with our first guest right after this. Maurice Copplethorne is a professor of law at the University of British Columbia. And he was also the last rapporteur on Iran to the United Nations Human Rights Commission. Very few people are as qualified to give us an insight into that country and the importance of looking at that country with grave concern and grave caution as Professor Copplethorne. And we welcome you back tonight. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Yesterday you were outlining why the United Nations decided that it didn't need a rapporteur on particular countries anymore and left it as regional groupings.
Mm-hmm.
What Has that at all affected what we know and what we should have known about Iran over the past 3 years? Would that have affected, for example, the optimism that we had before the last election when many people were looking at Iran and saying, well, women's groups are against the mullahs, the students are against the mullahs, and then we get Ahmadinejad? Was there a failure of baseline intelligence?
Well, I don't think the reports of special rapporteurs has that sort of impact. They're not widely read. They're read by people who make it their business to follow what's going on in a particular area, in my area, human rights in Iran. And I've heard that it was translated into Farsi fairly quickly, maybe 72 hours and available on the web. But to be caught with a copy of the reports inside Iran could get you into a lot of trouble. So I don't think that, and in Canada, how many people have you met who've read these reports? Some journalists read it and write up a report based on not only mine, but there are a dozen other special rapporteurs on Burma, Cambodia, a few places in Africa. I just don't think they're widely viewed as a major source of news by our media.
But, you know, I wonder about that. In my world, they are read, and, of course, in your world, they're read, and they're read, interestingly enough, as barometers of where the wind is going. Human rights somehow becomes a litmus test for where a society goes. And I don't think there was a truer place of that, a truer case of that than Iran.
Well,
there was we've spoken to a lot of people over the past few days about Khatami's past, and I remember something that Jim Woolsey said to us off air about. There was hope for Khatami when he got elected, and then after a year, he became sort of a wimp, to use Jim Woolsey's word. And part of the way they judged that was Khatami's response to the way the mullahs were dealing with human rights issues.
Yes, all of that is true. What I say doesn't take away from that. You're asking me really the impact of the fact that we have had no special rapporteur on Iran since 1992. 4 years now.
No, since 2002. You said 92 years.
Sorry, 2002. And that I'm just saying that is not a principal source for our media. Now, let me take it one step farther. When Special Rapporteur completes his report and submits it to the Human Rights Commission, there is no real debate about the report. It's just one of the realities of the world in which the Human Rights Commission worked. All sorts of people would jump up and say something not necessarily related to Iran, mm-hmm. and then eventually a resolution would be introduced which, quote, takes into account, unquote, the latest report of the special rapporteur, and then goes on to use other sources, and in the case of Iran, would normally condemn it. After noting that there had perhaps been some progress in some areas, but it still ended up with a definitive clause condemning Iran's behavior, and also then reappointing the special rapporteur. And that final sentence was the most important for me, because if that didn't appear, then I disappeared.
Did the reconstruction of the Human Rights Commission into the Human Rights Council this year, which gave a lot of people hope at one point that the commission would stop being controlled by certain states that had absolutely no business judging human rights, they were tyrannical regimes, does that reconstruction give you any hope, or have we gone back to business as usual?
Well, I don't think so yet. I think it's too young. It's less than 6 months old. Its first meetings, which were largely administrative meetings, were in June and July. And I think by Christmas time, by the new year, we should be able to see whether it is prepared to be bolder than the Human Rights Commission.
What would be your signs? What are the signposts?
Oh, the resolutions coming out of it concerning particular countries. For one of the requirements of the new system is that every country has to be reviewed for human rights. Okay, every country. That is to say, those that blocked the work of the Human Rights Commission as well as others. And I don't know how they're going to cope with this. It's a huge job, and I'm not sure there's the time around to do other than visit X countries, let's say 20 countries a year. But all that remains to be seen. And do remember that the process that was worked out was a compromise. It was not what it was not Canada or the U.S. or Scandinavian or European countries' first choice. It was a compromise,
right?
And that
they wanted to keep a lot more countries out.
Well,
the Western countries wanted to keep
out in the sense
or disqualify that, them from sitting on.
Out in the sense that they wanted the threshold higher for election to the Commission. And. And various people have argued that way in the past, and I've supported their argument. For example, a country which is not a party to the five so-called core human rights instruments shouldn't be on the Human Rights Commission. It shouldn't be in a position of judging other countries. That was anathema to the countries you've referred to, namely the ones who don't believe in international monitoring of human rights. But it seemed to me fairly basic.
Did it give you some hope? I mean, it did me, but I'm not a professional in the field as you are. I wasn't so deeply involved in as you were, and I hope that the gesture by Canada, the call by Canada for the arrest of Saeed Mortazawi that Iran sent as the observer to the UN Human Rights Council meetings, it was almost a slap in the face to it. And when the Harper government called for Mortazawi's arrest, and he was the prosecutor, Zahra Kazemi, it gave me pride. But more than giving me pride as a Canadian, what does it do inside the councils of power at the UN?
Mm-hmm.
Does that kind of a thing have an effect?
Well, it's pretty hard to say at this stage because, or for me, not having been there and it being such a new creation, I think Canada can be proud. I mean, I think I told you yesterday that I, too, have criticized Mortazawi and demanded that he be suspended from his position at the time that this happened. So I think he is, if you want, the symbol of the inadequacies of the Iranian judicial system, and that has to be investigated. It was one of the three areas I dealt with every time in my reports was the legal system.
Maurice Copplethorne, former United Nations Rapporteur in Iran for the UN Human Rights Commission. Many thanks for joining us tonight.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We'll be right back. As I said at the top of the hour, my day today started with a certain degree of irritation as I saw Jumpin' Jack Flash Layton on television talking about discussions with the Taliban. I don't know what he wants to discuss. I don't know what kind of values or rights to give up. We're going to keep hammering this point day after day and until we see that we're getting it right, because we believe that we can engage a citizenry. And a nation's spirit is often determined by what we do abroad and how we commit ourselves to our engagement in other people's transcendent yearnings for redemptive change and their struggles. And we're fighting people right now in Afghanistan that aren't going to sit down and discuss anything with anybody. And it's time that some of our political leaders get it. Thankfully, we have a prime minister who has set out a new course of pride and purpose for this country. And hopefully the country will follow. And if it follows, it'll be very much the result of public intellectuals like our next guest. To say that Barry Cooper is merely a professor of political science at the University of Calgary doesn't go far enough. I can tell you, Montreal, that his words and his writings and his views are looked at and studied at the highest levels of decision-making in this country, and here's an example of why. We've talked a lot about why we should be in Afghanistan, why our mission is important there, and Professor Cooper will expound on it in a moment. But I just want to read you one short paragraph from a recent piece he wrote. If Canada pulls out, aside from the loss of face, aside from the loss of confidence of our allies, the consequences for the ordinary citizens of Afghanistan would be disastrous, he wrote. Consider only this. The Taliban would be in a position to make good on its threat to throw acid in the face of any girl attending school. Barry Cooper of the University of Calgary, thank you for taking the time to be with us tonight.
You're quite welcome.
What's our problem in this country? Why don't more of Canadians get it? Why do we have a national leader of a political party talking about discussions with the Taliban?
That is probably really one of the one of the most important questions that Jack Layton could ever try and answer. And quite frankly, when he said that, I was even surprised at the perfidy of the NDP and the left generally in this country. Part of it may simply be wanting to take this kind of narcissistic distance from the United States, because they're clearly spearheading the conflict, the war, the attempt to get at the terrorists. But apart from that, I really don't know. It seems to be so irrational, even for the NDP.
The Prime Minister, of course, has not based his policies and as much pride as I feel and other like-minded people feel in his statements in Kandahar about Canadians not cunning and running, on other issues that involve the global war on terror. He made one central point, which you bring out in your piece, but knowing your enemy, that if we're not there, then we allow the incubator to continue, the incubator being Afghanistan, the political force of the Taliban, to support al-Qaeda and other terrorist movements. We do damage to ourselves, do we not, if we don't engage with our democratic allies, at least on the level of Australia, that has a place at the table in Washington when worldwide preparations are made for defense and war measures.
Yeah,
we're sort of back in the game since this prime minister was elected.
I think so. About the only criticism I would make of the prime minister is that it's kind of like President Bush in the early days in Iraq, that he hasn't sufficiently well explained the connection between Canadians' desire to live in under a certain kind of constitutional liberty at home and why we send our soldiers to Afghanistan. It's not that difficult to do. You have to say it more than once.
Yes.
I'm sure that in the months ahead he'll probably do that. But that's about the only thing I think that Stephen Harper hasn't done enough of. Because otherwise, I pay attention to what he says, and he certainly said all the right things.
We've had, through all the criticism, we sometimes get lost in the fact that a lot of what we're doing in Afghanistan is succeeding. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, I had lunch with a young man who just came back from a tour in the Marines, people like Peter Dimitrov of the National Democratic Institute, who trained the group, some 60,000 workers, helped train 60,000 workers in the recent elections. A lot of what is being done on the ground is working, and we're not getting enough of that message. And I'd like you to address that political media problem right after this break.
Okay. Yep.
Thank you. Montreal, we'll be right back. Or email us with your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. And we're speaking to Professor Barry Cooper, political science professor at the University of Calgary, and one of Canada's most important public intellectuals, particularly in the field of foreign and defense affairs. Professor Cooper, we were talking before the break about the medium and the message. Where is the disconnect? What aren't Canadians getting about our successes on the ground, and why aren't we getting it?
I think probably one of the reasons it's a structural reason. The media generally like to report on things that go wrong. There's never any stories, 173 Air Canada planes landed safely today. So they would much rather just report on, say, soldiers being shot or killed than they would on the development effort that's done there. And besides, there's not much to see. Even though a lot, in fact, has happened. I mean, it's not the easiest thing, as Canadians know, to put together some kind of constitution. The Afghanis have done that since Kabul and their country was liberated. So, there's a lot of things that have happened that are very difficult to sell it through the normal media.
Yet, as you mentioned earlier, in the context of understanding the mission is also a support mission for Afghanistan to keep building. It's not about instant gratification of body counts. It's not even about territory necessarily. It's about building stability, keeping the Taliban away, chasing them over the border into Pakistan to allow at least the foundations of a constitutional democracy to take hold in Afghanistan. It's a protective mission. It's not so much an aggressive mission, but which typically, if put that way, would be the kind of wording that Canadians would like. Let's use that term. That's not getting across.
Well, in fact, it is pretty aggressive. The Patricias and now the Royal Canadian Regiment, I think, have gone on some fairly, let's say, robust missions going into territory that was controlled by the Taliban. And the idea is not to sit down and talk with them, but to kill them. And, you know, they've been pretty successful doing that.
Clearly, I'm sorry, I might have misspoken. What I meant was, right now, what's the image that's not being painted is that our troops are involved in pushing the Taliban to the edge of Afghanistan. And the image here in Canada is that, gee, you know, this must be a failure because we've got fighting in every street. But we don't have fighting in every street. The fighting is at the periphery of the country.
Well, it is, yeah. And the other interesting thing is that they're trying to push these guys up into the border with Pakistan, and now finally, you know, at long last, some would say, the Pakistan government is going to perhaps let them be the anvil, so that the Canadians and the other coalition forces can pummel them, so they don't exist anymore. Even the Pakistanis have made some in the last week or so deals with the local guys up on the border to prevent them from turning the border into a sieve. So that'll improve things too.
How much trouble is it going to be to get Canadians broadly to understand that we are fighting a kamikaze mentality, and you quote in your piece the commentary of General Norman Schwarzkopf, who commanded the coalition troops in the first Gulf War, when he was told that many enemy soldiers were eager to die in battle because then they would see God. And he replied quite openly, "That's fine, our job is to arrange the meeting." How hard is it for Canadians to let it sink in? Do they somehow think that this is propaganda, that these aren't a bunch of kamikazes?
Well, I wouldn't say they're kamikazes. I think the motivations are a little bit different, but it'll take a while because for a couple of reasons. One is that we have had at least a generation, probably a generation and a half of political leaders that have made the argument that because we're such nice people, the rest of the world will leave us alone, that there are no real bad guys out there. They're just people that...
Misunderstood people, and we have to find the root causes.
Yeah, I mean, an enemy is just somebody who's not yet my friend, and we'll just make him friend someday. But the problem is that that enemies, you know, as Secretary of Defense in the U.S., Rumsfeld, said, that the enemy gets a vote, and if he doesn't want to be your friend, then there's not much you can do about it. That's something that Canadians have to figure out. I mean, in my dad's generation, it wasn't that hard to figure out. It seems to be a lot harder for certainly for my generation, and for even more so, I suppose, for my kids.
You anticipated my next question. It's the generational gap. Canada, in the first half of the century, we had twice as many men and women in uniform in World War I and World War II as America as a percentage of population. We understood the Canadian sacrifice. We understood the Canadian mythology. What's happened to us in the past 15 years?
Well,
we don't even celebrate that mythology anymore.
We celebrate it, I think, probably one day a year.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, and I mean, the interesting thing is with the pictures of Canadian troops now on the front pages just about every day, you know, generally under really unhappy circumstances, because they're funeral patrols, essentially, or funeral missions to put these their comrades back, you know, to send them back to Canada. That still has an impact, I think, on ordinary Canadians that hasn't been there for a long time. I mean, we've had this myth of peacekeeping that it, you know, feeds into the notion that because we're so nice, no one will ever take issue with
right.
us.
Which we never really were. I mean, this peacekeeping neutrality myth.
No. I mean, it's, at the same time that we were doing all this peacekeeping in Cyprus, there were basically 10,000 troops with tanks and airplanes ready to fight the Soviets in the North Germany.
Yeah, so, as late as the early 90s, I believe, we had seven major missions around the world, and we're lionizing a myth of peacekeeping and neutrality, not celebrating the legacy of service and sacrifice. It's a remarkable disconnect.
It is, and quite frankly, I think the responsibility for that lies in, as I said, a couple of generations of political leaders in this country that have not, you don't have to celebrate your your military achievements, but you certainly have to acknowledge them. It may not be that, you know, that it, wars are not very nice, so you can understand why people might not celebrate them, but simply to ignore what Canadian arms have done historically, it seems to me to be really misguided.
Barry Cooper, University of Calgary, many thanks for your time and many thanks for your words and wisdom.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
And we'll be right back. Tonight we're talking about how to get the message across about the importance of Canada's involvement abroad. How important it is for this nation to keep trust with its legacy of involvement with mankind's struggles for redemptive change. And there's something wrong with the way the message is getting across in many circles. Our next guest is an expert at many things in this field, both military and media. Brian MacDonald is a former colonel in the Canadian Forces, former past president of the Atlantic Alliance of Canada, the NATO Alliance, the support organization. He is senior security analyst for the Canadian Association, the Canadian Defense Association, and past president, former executive director of the Royal Military Institute. Brian MacDonald, welcome, and thanks for taking the time.
Barrow, I'm always glad to chat with you.
Is there anything you haven't done? That's a brief resume. Brian MacDonald, you know better than most of how you spend a lot of your professional life getting across the message of the importance of our military involvement. And I was saying earlier in the show how my day today started out really in a frustrating way watching Jumpin' Jack Flash late and talk about discussions with the Taliban, but got better around lunchtime when I one of the people at the lunch was an incredible young man in his mid-20s who had just finished 4 years with the Marines. He's a dual citizenship, American and Canadian, spent 9 months in Iraq, did a tour in Afghanistan, and he says, we're just not getting the real story of what's happening on the ground. We're only getting the negative stuff. And, you know, we hear the same from people like Peter Dimitrov, who is the country director for Afghanistan for the National Democratic Institute. What do we need to do as citizens? We can't always leave it up to a brave prime minister who set out a bold vision for us. But what can we as citizens do to make our co-citizens understand the importance of our engagement in democratic development abroad?
Well, Beryl, it's a really an incredible problem because, you know, just before we talked, I had looked at the Foreign Affairs Canada website and saw all the stuff there that is on the website, on the web, talking about the things that we've been doing in Afghanistan to help to turn that country around. And when people say, why are we there? And I think about the wealth of material that is out there, which shows clearly why we are there. I really wonder whether or not these people are actually asking a question or just simply asking a loaded question, which has a political motive behind it.
Right.
You know, when I look at the stuff that comes through from the Canadian International Development Agency, from Foreign Affairs Canada, from the Defense Department that talks about 5 million refugees are now back inside Afghanistan. Part of it, of course, comes from the contributions that we've been making of 3 million little girls who are back in school for the first time ever. Of the fact that
and not having acid thrown in their faces, our previous guest Barry Cooper said,
and not having their teachers' throats slit while they're sitting there in their seats in that school, which is about to be burned down by the Taliban. You know, I really wonder how can you be in this country with the things that we have been doing, the things that are good, and simply not be aware of it?
Is so much of what we're getting just partly knee-jerk anti-Americanism and the other part downright cowardice?
Well, I would hope that that is not the case. I mean, there is, of course, a traditional chunk of anti-Americanism, since part of my family is United Empire Loyalists, and we were on the losing side of
the
American
started
Revolution.
With you.
I've got a,
it started with
a
your
right,
gang.
I've got a right to be anti-American in one sense. But, you know, the Americans do what the Americans do, and the Americans do some dumb things, and the Americans do some really good things. So knee-jerk anti-Americanism, to me, is a dumb response. But I wish that we could pay attention. You know, the image that I have of that tiny little girl in Afghanistan who can go to school and start the process of being the first person in her family who can read, that seems to me to be is something that really requires a bit more emphasis.
Brian MacDonald, we'll be right back with you. We're just going to pay some bills. We'll be back after this. And email us with your comments at info@iapm.ca. We're talking with retired Canadian Forces Colonel Brian McDonald, Senior Defense Analyst with the Conference of Defense Associations. Brian, we were talking before the break about getting the message out about the stuff that is happening on the ground. We've got, you know, kids going to school, hydroelectric grids restored, hospitals operating at almost 100% capacity, constitutional democracy being protected in Afghanistan. If we don't get it on the Afghani mission and successes, how do we prepare this country for what is looking inevitably to be another conflict with another Mideast threat, namely Iran?
Well, Bear, I mean, this is one of the great things that leaves me scratching my head. You know, the story that's come out now about the resolution coming from Nanaimo Cowichan to the NDP.
Unbelievable.
Accusing the Canadian guys in Afghanistan of being terrorists. I mean,
for those listeners that don't know this, there's a resolution to be debated at the NDP convention, policy convention, whether or not our young men and women are war criminals in Afghanistan. No debate about the Taliban who beheaded women. No debate about the Taliban who threw acid in the faces of girls who dared to go to school. No debate about the Taliban who murdered homosexuals. No, but about the people who are making freedom that they're debating. Outstanding, Brian, and this from a bunch of socialists who themselves would be killed under a Taliban regime.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, I just simply really sit here and sort of hold my head in my hands and saying, how can people be so disconnected from the world? You know, at this point, one of the great problems in Afghanistan is the fact of the opium and heroin trade. I mean, statistics out from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime just in the last 10 days have pointed out that Afghanistan is now responsible for 92% of the entire world production of opium and heroin. And 55% of that comes from the area in which the Canadian troops are now deployed, trying to restore order and some sense of dignity there. You know, the drug traffickers who are in an unholy alliance with the Taliban in that area have basically an industry that is generating something in the order of $1.4 billion a year. And this is, of course, one of the things that has to be shut down because that's the source of the Taliban financial support.
The Canadian mission, particularly the recent Operation Medusa, was pretty extraordinary for Canadian troops crossing an international border. We were not only in harm's way, but we led the fight and we chased the enemy. This is the kind of stuff that, you know, if this was the United States, we'd have a movie of the week in about a month. And yet we don't hear about this heroism here in Canada.
And not only don't hear about it, then we have...
And we succeeded. I mean,
Coast accusing our guys of being terrorists.
We have there's a tremendous capacity in certain parts of the country to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. It's almost we like self-flagellation.
Yeah, but again, by the same token, when you actually start looking at the letters to the editor, the email letters to the editor, you also begin to appreciate there's a deep, deep well of support amongst the Canadian people. You know, the guys who are the people who drive the truck to work in the morning, who recognize, in fact, what the Canadian forces are doing, recognize what the Canadian financial contributions through CETA and through foreign affairs are doing, recognize the force for good that the Canadian participation in Afghanistan is. And that's encouraging.
That is encouraging, but what is it going to take to get through to the chattering classes, the salon liberals out your way, the 416 and the 905?
Well, I'm not sure what is going to be required to get through to all of the chattering classes, but I certainly do have a pretty good feel that a whole bunch of the people out there are now getting more and more and more angered by the message that they are receiving, which they are increasingly seeing is a message that doesn't have truth behind it.
Right. You know, it's not only the 416 and the 905. I wish we'd see more of that in Quebec, where, you know, we had this terrible rally that turned into a pro-Hezbollah demonstration with political leadership at the front of it, and who refused to leave. And the signal that sends out, you know, in their defense, they tried to say that, well, you know, we can't be held responsible for what happens at a rally, except they could have left. It sends the wrong message from the top down.
Well, you're absolutely right, Beryl. And, you know, as you and I have talked before, the Quebecois side of my family goes very deep in Quebec. It goes back to Jean Normandin in 1650 and Marie Valade, who was in the first wave of the Fille du Roi. So when I see some of the comments that are coming out of Quebec, given my deep roots in the province, I get really a bit concerned.
Mais finalement, nous vaincrons.
Mm.
Finally, we will win. Brian McDonald, thanks very much for your time.
Cheryl, always glad to talk.
Take care.
Bye.
Montreal, that's it for tonight. Thanks to Nick Mays of Master Control. I want to leave you with one memory, one notion. Barry Cooper mentioned it earlier. His generational disconnect about our place and our involvement with people suffering around the world. And there is something from not too long ago that young people should remember today. President John Kennedy said it. Each person suffering diminishes me. And that's why we as Canadians need to be involved in mankind's struggles for redemptive change. We'll be back tomorrow night.